person. No, you shouldn't be so apprehensive. 1 minute.
Professor Strauss, Philosophy of Plato, Session 11, May 3rd, 1965, Pythagoras.
No, no, I think it would really. If I take off my coat, you could say.
No, I thought you were.
It's not. It's not, yes. What's it? And I didn't hear.
I was encouraging him to remove the jacket and maybe not to think of it.
Shows again that you are a true scientist. Good. Now, I will remind you of something which some of you will have forgotten, and namely that what one must not forget if one wants to have the maximum benefit of, derive the maximum benefit from reading this dialogue, namely the early parts, the conversation with the comrade, the conversation with Hippocrates, and so on. I will say something about the subject at a later date, perhaps next time. Now we turn to our immediate context, and I remind you of it. In his long speech, consisting of a myth and a logos, Protagoras had drawn a picture most flattering to virtue. Every member of society is a teacher of virtue. There is a gradation among the teachers. Teachers of all, and teachers of the sons of the rich. Teachers of all, and teachers of the gifted. And somehow, Protagoras is at the top of the whole teaching profession. Something that I think it would be unfair to both sides to compare him to Mr. Willis here in Chicago. The teaching profession is a profession teaching virtue. His debate with Socrates, which follows on the long speech, shows how shaky that virtue is. It shows it if one reads it with some care. We have seen that the relation between justice and piety is obscure. But still more obscure is the relation of justice, piety on the one hand, and moderation, wisdom on the other. It is not excluded that the prudent or wise man, the moderate and wise man, and hence Protagoras, is unjust, and vice versa, that the just man may be a fool. But we know this view, for example, from Callicles in the Gorgias. But Protagoras is surely not a Callicles. He is a cautious foreigner. When the going gets rough, he refuses to give short answers and embarks on a long speech. And this leads to the interruption of the discussion. An altercation between Socrates and Protagoras starts. And this means that what we have heard before as an argument in speech, namely the relation of moderation, wisdom on the one hand and justice on the other, is now being enacted before our eyes. Let me say the two parts of virtue, let me define them provisionally as follows. Moderation as the ability to take care of one's own interests, and justice, complying with the interests of others or with the common good. Now, we have begun to read that last time and arrived at 335c8. The situation, Socrates wishes to leave because Protagoras refuses to continue giving short answers. And Protagoras said, why can you want to lay down the law? How can you do that? Good. And now, I think we continue just at this point in 35C7. And it's a moment I have said this.
Thus I spoke, and was rising from my seat with the intention of leaving, when Callias seized hand, the right hand, and in his left hand caught hold of this old cloak of mine. He said, "We shall not let you go, Socrates, for if you leave us, this will be the end of our discussion. I must therefore beg you to remain, as there is nothing in the world that I should like better than to hear you and Protagoras discourse. Do not deny the company this pleasure."
Yeah, to gratify all of us. Now we see here Socrates' great fairness. He would gladly listen to another long speech. No, that was before, but I remind you of that. He would gladly listen to another long speech of Protagoras, but he is busy, as I said shortly before. Now, but we know that he is not busy, and in order not to mince words, we say he lies. But lying is a kind of injustice, so that is injustice. But he has, of course, his injustice has a noble justification. Why does he wish to stay? Why, if he can?
High time Hippocrates was taken.
So in other words, he lies not for his own amplification, but for the good of somebody else. Now, here we see in what Mr. Rankin just read, that Socrates himself is forced to stay for the sake of the common good. But since he is forced to stay, since he doesn't stay voluntarily, this only confirms the impression that he is not just. This little point which must have struck you, that he explains so clearly how Callias took hold of him. With the right, he took his hand, and with the left, this old coat, a crude common coat. The implication, just an old coat. So that is, it's not dressed up. Where is he dressed up?
Pardon?
No, let us not always go to the highest level. In which dialogue is he dressed up?
In the symposium.
In the symposium. And we have seen that there are quite a few cross relations between the two dialogues. Yes. What does Socrates say now?
"Now I had got up and was on the verge of departing. Son of Hipponicus," I replied.
That is Callias, yeah. And which adds to the solemnity. Mm-hmm. Yes.
"Son of Hipponicus, I have always admired and do now heartily applaud and love your desire for wisdom."
Yeah, well, in Greek the word philosophia, because philosophia means love of wisdom. Yeah.
"And would gladly comply with your request if I could. But the truth is that I cannot. And what you ask is as great an impossibility to me as if you bade me run a race and keep pace with Creson of Himera when in his prime, or with some long-distance runner or courier. To such a request, I should reply that I would fain ask the same of my own legs, but they refuse to comply. And therefore, if you want to see Creson and me in the same race, you must bid him slacken his speed to mine. For I
In other words, transform the race into a non-race. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It might be amusing to see that, but it is surely no longer a race. Yes?
"For I cannot run quickly, and he can run slowly. And in like manner, if you want to hear me and Protagoras discoursing, you must ask him to shorten his answers and keep to the point as he did at first? If not, how can there be any discussion? For discussion is one thing, and making an oration is quite another.
You're making a public speech, making a speech to the demons is another. Now, Socrates refuses to stay under the conditions. Ultra posse, nemo obligato. No one is obliged to do anything beyond his power. And of course, the discussion is not a race. Now you see the joke here when he speaks of Creason and the other kind of runners. Creason was a very famous man who had won a number of races at a few Olympian Games. Protagoras may be equally well compared to a particularly famous champion and to any of a large group of runners. You see, the compliment for Protagoras is also qualified here. Yes. Now, and the dialogue between Socrates and Protagoras, of course, would be a very unexciting thing. Because they are not equals, that's also implied. In dialogue, Socrates is much better, and Socrates, of course, does not change his tempo for the sake of Protagoras. And therefore, such a conversation is also unexciting for the reason given here for regarding long speeches. Yes?
But you see, Socrates.
So the conflict is very clear now. Protagoras wants one thing, Socrates wants the other, and no possibility of reconciliation. Yes?
But you see, Socrates, said Callias, that Protagoras may fairly claim to speak in his own way, just as you claim to speak in yours.
Yeah, you see, more literally, the word he uses, Protagoras seems to say just things. In other words, Callias says, Socrates, you are unjust. Protagoras is just. For he demands that everyone should be free to converse as he likes. Equal rights for each. Nothing seems to be more just. Socrates rejects this view, as we can say already now. No equal rights for unequal people, as we have seen. The razor in Socrates, and Protagoras and Socrates are not equals. Protagoras is there and Socrates is here. Justice demands that the superior must make concessions to the inferior if there is to be a community among them. But we must say, is after all Socrates not in fact, the superior man? Ought not he to be the one who makes concessions to Protagoras? Yes, except for one point. He has to consider Hippocrates. Must never forget that. Mr. Tryon?
No.
Is all right? Yeah. So in other words, Socrates is in a way unjust. But this injustice has a just reason. Whereas Protagoras' justice, just as it is, has an unjust reason, because it has to do with his prestige, not being impaired, and that is not a sound reason. Yes?
This great concern, Hippocrates, makes one believe that Hippocrates is a pure sort of fellow who is horribly corrupted easily. But we saw from his first statement to Socrates, Socrates is far corrupted from the point of view of Socrates. And in fact, he was greatly entranced with Pythagoras, and Pythagoras is destroyed with entranced with the next big name that comes down the pipe. In other words, is he probably being a little kind to Socrates by saying he always wants to defend
Yeah, well, that is a much broader question. In other words, you assert that the whole assumption underlying the dialogue, the hypothesis, as the Greeks say, is itself ironical.
Well, Yes, I think there's some humor in it.
Yes, I would admit that. But we have first to take the what we see very literally and seriously, and then we can perhaps later on take up the question. Why does Socrates do such like things, regardless of whether Hippocrates is the apparent cause for justification or not? Good. Now let us first follow the litigation. So, yes. Now on other, yes?
Just a technical point, but does Callias say that both Socrates and Protagoras say just things, or that Protagoras says?
Protagoras says.
Because there's a textual
thing,
whether it's
Stoa or Sokrates. Protagoras? No, that is Protagoras' point. Protagoras says everyone should be free to converse as he likes. And if Protagoras likes to make long speeches and Sokrates does not like to hear long speeches, that's too bad for Sokrates. It's Protagoras' point of view. It will come perfectly clear from this secret. Now?
Here, Alcibiades interposed.
You know, the great Alcibiades.
And said, that, Callias, is not a true statement of the
case.
No.
You do not speak nobly. He must translate this letter. And which can include, can also mean you don't speak justly, but has a broader meaning. He in fact means here that Callias Callias' proposal is unjust, but that will become, let us first read this whole passage.
For our friend Socrates.
Of course, our friend Socrates here.
For this Socrates admits that he cannot make a speech. In this he yields the palm.
Meaning a long speech, yeah?
Oration.
Yeah.
In this he yields the palm to Protagoras. But I should be greatly surprised if he yielded to any living man in the ability to handle the give and take of argument. Now, if Protagoras will make a similar admission and confess that he is inferior to Socrates in argumentative skill, that is enough for Socrates.
See, he speaks on behalf of Socrates. He is strictly an agonistic man, the race. And if Protagoras concedes defeat right at the beginning, well, that's all we need, yes?
But if he claims a superiority in argument as well, let him ask and answer, not when a question is asked, slipping away from the point, and instead of answering, making a speech at such length that most of his hearers forget the question at issue. Not that Socrates is likely to forget. I will be bound for that, although he may pretend in fun that he has a bad memory. And Socrates,
you remember, Socrates had said that he has a poor memory. Now, and Alcibiades leaves the cat out of the bag. Yes. Yes?
And Socrates appears to me to be more in the right than Protagoras.
Yeah, well, the term used here is the one which, since Aristotle, has a clear meaning of equity, the higher kind of justice. But we cannot necessarily presuppose that here. And we can, however, translate. To me, Socrates seems to say the more equitable thing. Yes?
That is my view, and every man ought to say what he thinks.
Yeah, very good. The honest democrat Alcibiades. Now, Alcibiades is obviously the bottle holder for Socrates. And he says very clearly, siding with Socrates, that the opponent of Socrates, Protagoras, acts unjustly. Socrates had not insisted on his right. Socrates had only kindly requested what Alcibiades asks for as a matter of right. Namely, then, since he is the poorer of the two, Protagoras should make the concession to him. Implied is justice is not equality, but recognition of superiority or inferiority. We also note this point about Socrates' playfulness. We have said Socrates lies. this is of course a harsh statement. Protagoras brings it down to its proper proportion. He says sugar is jokes. But needless to say that a jocular lie is still a lie. We must not forget that. Yes. So now it is perfectly clear each of the two antagonists has found a bottle holder. But this only aggravates the difficulty, it doesn't solve it. Now, what comes next?
When Alcibiades had done speaking, someone, Critias, I believe, spoke. Oh, Prodicus and Hippias, Callias appears to me to be a partisan of Protagoras. And this led Alcibiades, who loves opposition, to take the other side. But we should not be partisans either of Socrates or of Protagoras. Let us rather unite in entreating both of them not to break up the discussion.
In between, yeah. Now, Socrates doesn't say that Critias said it. He only says, I believe. This is a reminder that this is not always a verbatim report. I believe no one of you believed that it was always a verbatim report of an actual conversation. But it is not uninteresting that it is pointed out here. Now, Critias does not say, if you read carefully, that Alcibiades sides with Socrates. In a way, Critias himself sides with Socrates, as we have seen at the initial scene. Alcibiades and Critias came together after Socrates and Hippocrates, that formed a kind of group by itself, as you remember. Critias sides with Socrates only to one extent, inasmuch as Socrates, in contradistinction to Protagoras, wishes to continue the discussion. Now, Critias brings up another aspect of justice. Justice is impartiality. We all know that. By bringing in Prodicus and Hippias, as he does here, he unwittingly prepares that deliberation with the other sophists, which Socrates had quasi-promised to Hippocrates in 314 B2C. So we have now, equitably, the establishment of a court of justice. It begins with the proposal of Critias. Now, how does it go on? You remember, Critias had started it, and now the two other sophists speak subsequently, one after the other. Yes?
Prodicus added, that, Critias, seems to me to be well said. For those who are present at such discussions ought to be impartial hearers of both the speakers, remembering, however, that impartiality is not the same as equality. For both sides should be impartially heard, and yet an equal need should not be assigned to both of them, but to the wiser a higher need should be given, and a lower to the less wise.
Yeah. Now, Prodicus accepts the role of arbiter, but he demands unequal distribution. More to the wiser, less to the unwise. Yes?
And I, as well as Critias, would beg you, Protagoras and Socrates, to grant our request.
You see now the formation of a third party. Yeah? Yeah. Socrates and Protagoras, the two parties, and now a third party, which throws some light on foreign policy in our age. Yes?
Which is that you will dispute with one another and not wrangle. For friends dispute with friends out of goodwill, but only adversaries and enemies wrangle. And then our meeting will be most delightful. For in this way, you who are the speakers will be most likely to win esteem and not praise only among us.
No, not win praise. He explained that.
And not mere praise?
And not be praised. No mere. Yeah?
Oh, that's what it says.
Yeah.
And not mere praise among us who are your audience. For esteem is a sincere conviction of the hearer's souls, but praise is often an insincere verbal expression of men uttering falsehoods contrary to their conviction. And thus we, who are the hearers, will be gratified and not pleased. For gratification is of the mind when receiving wisdom and knowledge, but pleasure is of the body when eating or experiencing some other bodily delight.
Yeah. Now, this is in a way a very crude parody of Prodigal's hobby or specialty. And it makes subtle distinctions between the meaning of different terms and in order to avoid logical errors. Now, what Prodigal does here is to appeal to the better part of Protagoras and Socrates. The implication is that he is morally superior to both, and he admonished them to be friends. This is all we have to consider now, and now let us see how it goes on.
Thus spoke Prodicus, and many of the company applauded his words.
So, you see, Prodicus does not receive universal applause, universal praise, as in quite a few others. Hippias will receive universal praise, a praise soon after, and we will see that this is very meaningful. We can, however, make one, but why should Prodigal's speech not receive universal praise if we disregard this distinction, that such a distinction of terms, and consider the substance of his speech? What did he say which is not very popular?
Yes. That the wise deserve more than the unwise.
Yes, I think so. Now let us go turn to the next speech.
Hippias the sage spoke next.
He's the only one who is given this manifestly ironical adjective here of the wise one. Yeah. You remember him before, yeah? He was a physicist and the half-mathematician. Yes?
He said, all of you who are here present, I reckon to be kinsmen and friends and fellow citizens by nature, and not by convention. For by nature, life is akin to life, whereas convention is the tyrant of mankind, and often compels us to do many things which are against nature. How great would be the disgrace, then, if we, who know the nature of things,
Yeah, but this has a very powerful literal meaning, the nature of things, especially of the natural things. Yes?
And are the wisest of the Hellenes, and as such are met together in this city, which is the center of wisdom in Hellas, and in the greatest and most glorious house of this city, should have nothing to show worthy of this height of dignity, but should only quarrel with one another like the meanest of mankind.
Well, let us stop here. You see the picture, there is some wisdom in the world, but concentrated in Greece. And in Greece it is concentrated in Athens. And in Athens still it is concentrated in the house of that great fool Callias. Now the physicist Hippias addresses all men present, whereas Prodigus had addressed only Socrates and Protagoras. All men present are friends, because all of them are wise, meaning of course also Callias and the others. And no wonder that, read a little bit later after the end of his speech, and after the end of his speech.
This proposal was received by the company with universal approval.
And all praised him. Naturally, everyone was flattered. And he appeals to natural right, as you see here. All wise men are akin and fellow citizens. They all wise men form a city. And this is, of course, a natural city, not a conventional city. they help one another as fellow citizens and do not help the unwise. For the unwise are people who by definition cannot be helped because they would make a mess of every help they are given. Now this is a very important point for the understanding of this kind of literature. To mention the most famous, if you state it in generalization, helping friends and not helping or perhaps even harming the non-friends, the enemies. Did you ever hear this view? Where? Huh? Where? Who says it? Paulet Marchaux, with reference to the poet Simonides, who will come up here soon. Yeah, but in the dialogue Cleitophon, which has come down to us as a Platonic dialogue, now generally regarded as spurious, Cleitophon, an adherent of the Sophist Thrasymachus, says that the Socratic view of justice is justice consists in helping friends and hurting enemies. And in the Aristophanes' Clouds, which is in a way anti-Socratic, this is the principle on which Socrates' pupil, Strepsiades, acts. He refuses to pay his debts to the creditors because he is wise and they are not wise. And there are no obligations of the wise to the unwise. Hippias, in contradistinction to Prodicus, implies the equality, not of all men, nonsense, as some people have understood it. But I have only one intelligible word, of all intellectuals, in the widest sense, i.e. people who do nothing but reading and or writing, or similar things. Well, this must of course be defined. You can say a bank clerk also does nothing but reading and writing, but no one would call him an intellectual, but so you must improve a bit on my provisional definition. And this gives him the terrific applause. You see, the Socratic concept is always between the true intellectual and the sham intellectual. Just as we make a distinction between a true physician and a sham physician. Now in this case the distinction is fairly simple because we ask him to produce a diploma. But there are no diplomas for intellectuals. You cannot possibly get such a diploma from any institution. But the half-heartedness and inconsistency of Hippias is of course shown by the fact that this natural city of the wise consists exclusively of Greeks. And why should there not be non-Greek wise men? What he understands by the wise men are the more sophisticated among the Greek gentlemen, and including of course himself and the others. But we have not yet, we must finish his speech now.
I do pray and advise you, Protagoras.
Now he addresses the two antagonists themselves, yes?
And you, Socrates, to agree upon a compromise. Let us be your peacemakers. And do not you, Socrates, aim at this precise and extreme brevity in discourse, if Protagoras objects.
No, if it is not pleasant to Protagoras, I simply do not know why they make this silly unliteralization. Because that one is as good English, I believe, as the other. So it can only be some desire to deviate by hook and by crook from the letter that it takes. And what is underlying that, I think we would have to call in Dr. Freud or someone. Yes. Okay.
But loosen and let go the reins of speech, that your words may present themselves grander and more graceful before us. Neither do you, Protagoras, go forth on the gale with every sail set out of sight of land into an ocean of words, but let there be a mean observed by both of you. Do as I say. And let me also persuade you to choose an umpire.
To elect, yeah. You can make it quite clear. Yeah.
To elect an umpire, or overseer, or president. He will keep watch over your words, and will prescribe their proper length.
Yes, the medium length, one could say. You see, Hibbias goes beyond Prodicus in his bracket proposal. He does not leave it as Prodicus did at admonition, behave like friends. He proposes an institutional safeguard, an arbiter. And the implication, of course, is that Protagoras and Socrates are not wise enough. And each of them pursues one extreme, the one the terribly short speeches and the other the terribly long speeches. Let there be a wiser man who will watch the right mean between shortness and brevity, and let him be the arbiter. And of course, for this reason, as well as the one before, he receives universal applause. Yes. Now?
This proposal was received by the company with universal applause.
Yeah, and all praised it. That one must keep in mind. What is praised universally and what is not? That Plato didn't make these distinctions for nothing. Yes?
Don't we have to say that remember Prodicus's definition of praise? It's possible.
You know, that would, you know, but since it has been ridiculed, yeah, I do not believe that we can accept that he can ascribe this to Plato, yeah, or Socrates for that matter. Yes.
Does the last proposal of Hippias mean that his natural city is in need of that convention to correct the fault?
That's a very good point, yeah. So in other words, in fairness to Hippias, we must say that he says the nomos does many things against nature. He doesn't say the nomos does everything against nature. Yeah? That's a good point. Yeah. Truly, that is a typical example of a convention that must be established by human agencies, such an arbiter.
Can we say conclusively that this is praise unanimously? Because either it's such a singular insight into the nature of man, it's good about unequal people going together and equal people going to get along, because it appeals to the vanity of these second-string sophists of present.
Well, there are not only second-string sophists, but there are also Athenian citizens, you know, who want to be belong to the avant-gardists.
Yeah? That's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
These people feel some satisfaction of their vanity and being lumped together.
Yeah, but don't all people like, I mean, all with some exceptions on some occasions, to be praised as wise? As a very nasty man once put it, many hopes, and said, to disagree with a man means tacitly to accuse him of ignorance. And this is his explanation of the fact why discussions become so easily nasty, you know, because a man whose view is contested regards himself as insulted by the disagreement.
Well, I agree with that. My question was aimed at, so if that's so, how much significance should we attach to the fact that the praise here was universal as opposed to being only partial?
No, I would say Sabon should not disregard the point which I made and which I believe you repeated, namely that Protagoras had spoken only of Protagoras and Prodicus had spoken only of Protagoras and Socrates as wise men. And he says we all are wise. And that is true. But it has, of course, something to do also with the thing. Prodicus led only to admonition, and Protagoras arrived at a proposal, so to speak, with teeth in it. It doesn't have true teeth, as we shall see, but it is at least an attempt at an institutional guarantee in contradistinction to a mere admonition. Mr. Lee.
Is there anything at all significant that the one who is rooted is the most foolish of them, hippiest the sage, the one who is kidded for his lack of wisdom, is the one who is the closest to a philosopher capable of the...
Yeah, but to a caricature of the philosopher king, we will see that in the immediate scene. But no, let me put it this way. In a way, the whole Protagoras is a justification of Hippias over against Protagoras. We cannot see that now, but as in anticipation, I know that, because the last section of the Protagoras contains a vindication of the art of measurement, and that is of course a mathematical art, and we know that Hippias liked these things and Protagoras looked down on these things. So that, yeah, but this only means that even a less intelligent and man may occasionally hit on an important point which a man superior to him misses. That we know there are no mechanical devices here, and I believe they will never be found. Now let us go on.
Callias said that he would not let me off, and they begged me to choose an overseer. But I said that to choose an umpire of discourse would be unseemly, for if the person chosen was inferior, then the inferior or worse ought not to preside over the better. Or, if he was equal, neither would that be well. For he who is our equal will do as we do, and what will be the use of choosing him? And, if you say, let us have a better then, to that I answer that, as a matter of fact, you cannot have anyone who is wiser than Protagoras. And if you choose another who is not really better, and who you only say is better, to put another over him as though he were an inferior person would be an unworthy reflection on him.
Is it not perfectly clear? It's impossible to choose an arbiter. An inferior, obviously, is an insult. An equal is impractical, he would make the same thing. And a superior is unthinkable. If you have a man of such superior wisdom as Protagoras, there can be no arbiter, no superior, no ruler of the wise. Impartiality is very well, but impartiality without wisdom will be of no use. He exaggerates. Sometimes the simple impartiality will do, as we all know. But in cases of any intricacy, there is no use. Impartiality is not enough, obviously. The wise man is a sole and sufficient judge of what he chooses. If Protagoras chooses long speeches, he is the best judge. And if he thinks that Socrates overdoes his praise of Protagoras and regards himself as equally wise, it also means Socrates, if he chooses short speeches, no one can interfere with them. In other words, let me make this quite clear what the issue is. The wise man does not pay respect to the opinion of the unwise, i.e. to an unwise opinion. That's to say, he is concerned with his good. He is, according to the definition suggested in the debate between Socrates and Protagoras, moderate, dash, wise. But he is not just. He is not just, because by justice we understand now a deference to the opinion of others, regardless of whether they are wise or unwise. You see how our subject, moderation, wisdom versus justice, is continued here indeed. Of course, in a comical way, this is a piece of a comedy, but in a good comedy there is always an underlying seriousness. Someone raised his hand. Mr. Schulzky.
Well, then we sort of get a vindication of Callias' original opinion that each
each one should be allowed to speak the way he wants to. Pratyahara should make long speeches and Socrates shows.
Yeah, but Socrates refuses to listen. That's an injustice of Socrates. Let us see how this develops.
Well, yeah. It would be an unworthy reflection on Pythagoras. Not that, as far as I am concerned, any reflection is of much consequence.
Socrates
to me.
Is here, of course, since in one sense is of course not mock humility, because Socrates is not vain. That is somehow the presupposition of the whole presentation. But that does not mean that Socrates is humble, in the sense that he is not aware of his superiority to the others, if that is the meaning of humility. Yes?
Let me tell you then what I will do in order that the conversation and discussion may go on as you desire. If Protagoras is not disposed to answer, let him ask and I will answer. And I will endeavor to show at the same time how, as I maintain, he ought to answer.
To and show him? Did he not bring this out?
No.
Disgraceful. You see, there's a very high claim. I'm going to give Protagoras, the man of little wisdom, I'm going to give Protagoras, the wise man, a lesson in how to do that.
At the same time, how, as I maintain, he ought to answer. And when I have answered...
No, how, in my opinion, the answerer should answer, not merely... we'll give him a lesson in short speeches. Whereas he's perfectly willing to grant that Protagoras is a past master in long speeches. But now we are concerned with short speeches. Because there is no time, we recall, to listen to long speeches. Yeah. Yes.
And when I have answered as many questions as he likes to ask, let him in like manner answer me. And if he seems to be not very ready at answering the precise question asked of him, you and I will unite in entreating him, as you entreated me, not to spoil the discussion. And this will require no special overseer. All of you shall be overseers together.
Yeah. Socrates has the best of two worlds. He considers the wishes of the others. The wish for arbitration, after he has shown that arbitration is impossible, he makes his great concession, you all are arbiters. But why does he make this concession? In order that his wish to be considered afterward. So Protagoras will first answer the questions. No, Socrates will answer the question, but then, in the later stage, Socrates will again be in the position of the questioner. In other words, the compromise proposed by Socrates is entirely a compromise on Socrates' terms, not on Protagoras' terms. That is especially clear in the passage to which I referred. I am going to teach him what it means to give brief answers. All will be overseers of Protagoras' conduct. A kind of democracy we get in this way. If he who answers knows, because a non-knower cannot answer, and therefore is wise, Socrates now admits that he is wise. He can answer the questions, and not merely raise questions. The comical exaggeration, you must always take into account that there is more than that. He even admits that he is able to teach Protagoras how to answer. He refuses to be subjected to an arbiter, because he is at least as good as any other. All these features at first glance are signs of an unjust man. But this injustice is a special one. Yes, now, the end of this speech.
This was generally approved.
By all. Because generally can also mean not universally, but in Greek it's perfectly clear. Yeah, all agree. Yes.
All agree. And Protagoras, though very much against his will, was obliged to agree.
Was compelled. Why, obliging is not the same as compelling. And he is perfectly, was forced.
Was compelled to agree that he would ask questions, and when he had put a sufficient number of them, that he would answer in his turn those which he was asked in short replies.
In other words, no long speeches anymore. That's out. No long speeches. So this is completely victorious. The apparent compromise is in fact not a compromise at all. Protagoras is compelled by the others to dance to Socrates' tune. Yes?
How do these rules that Socrates established for the discussion make any different from that umpire that he said couldn't be elected? Isn't he, in a way, prescribing overseeing the words and the length of the words in the same way as the overseer?
Yeah, but there is no special change. It makes a great difference. And if you have ever been in a meeting led by a chairman who was an efficient chairman, and a meeting in which there is no chairman except someone who says, you come now, and would never conduct the whole thing, it would make a great difference. Now, Protagoras is compelled to accept Socrates' proposal, compelled to continue the conversation. You remember in 335b1, Socrates had observed that Protagoras would not voluntarily continue the conversation. Well, he is now forced to do it. Socrates has successfully used justice for his purpose. But this purpose includes justice, namely consideration for Hippocrates and other people like this kind. So we have seen before, when we saw an earlier scene, you know, when Socrates compared the men he saw in Callias's house to figures from Hades, Tantalus, you know, protocols like Tantalus and so on. Socrates is the Odysseus, but a just Odysseus. I mean, now, here you raise it. Yes?
Surely Protagoras, we know that Protagoras sees that he has been defeated because he says very much against his will. But why does he not at this point attempt a long speech explaining why in fact this is a bad way to search for truth or something?
Yeah, but somehow wouldn't fit into his consideration. He wants to win.
He could by making even at this point make a long speech.
Then Socrates would have left. So they said, I refuse to listen to any long speeches. One of the most striking things in the litigation scene, as we may call that, is something which which isn't there, and which you see only if you ask what is missing. Protagoras doesn't say a word in this whole litigation scene. And that is quite, after all, Protagoras is not exactly a mute man, you know. Now let me say a few words about the litigation scene in general. Here Socrates shows not only that Protagoras is a poor teacher, that he had shown already in the debate, but also that he is a poor public speaker. The term used in 336b3, where Socrates says Protagoras should not engage in public speech, in rhetoric. Protagoras is completely silent in this scene, after the beginning, and which means, in practical terms, he cannot take care of his interests. Callias must work for him or so. He lacks the ability to advise himself well regarding his benefit. Others must take care of him. He loses because he is unobliging, while Socrates is or appears to be obliging, says, well, my long speeches, I'm sorry. I'm not good at that, I grant that. All right. Or on another level, long speech is wonderful, but I have no time. That this contradicts itself is another matter, but it is at least obliging. Protagoras, the alleged teacher of good advice, lacks good advice in his own case. Now, but being obliging, i.e. ceding from one's right, is rudimentary justice, perhaps even more than rudimentary justice. Hence Socrates acts on the principle that it is moderate or wise to be just. It is to your own interest if you are obliging, if you cede. The man who wants to have more, who wants to win, loses. Nothing could be more edifying. Protagoras loses. For Protagoras explicitly acts on the principle that it is good to have more. 335c, as you will see when he says, I would not be that famous personality if I had always conducted my speeches according to the wishes of my opponents. Socrates seems to do the same. This leads to conflict. And hence, since these are not savages, the demand for arbitration or for impartial justice. But impartiality is not enough. The arbiter must also be wise. But take any very simple case, if the object of arbitration is some stock exchange speculation, where you have to be very wise in stock exchange, how could a man ignorant of these things be an arbiter? Therefore, there cannot be arbiters, i.e. rulers, of the wise. The wise cannot be obliged to obey laws made by unwise people, because that's fundamentally the same case. Yet, by being obliging to the unwise, Socrates succeeds in laying down the law favorable to him. That is so, it's a strange comedy. But as every comedy, it is of course unreal, as people say, untrue. It abstracts from something very important. What is the effective truth of this simple proposition that a man like Socrates, who is so prudent, so obliging, takes best care of his interests, and he will lay down the law?
This is a select group Socrates was
saying. Exactly. And what are the... this is surely not universally true. So we only have to remember Socrates' defeat in the trial of the generals after the Battle of the Arginusae, and especially his defeat in his own trial. Socrates succeeds only in the company of the Sophists and their adherents, i.e. in an environment where only speeches count. But in the polis, not only speeches count. There may be a very poor speaker who gets most of the ballots. And behind that is brachial power, ultimately. Brachial power. And therefore, here no one thinks of fighting it out in a muscular way. It is all done by speeches. So that is a great point which will come up again. Now someone, Mr. Dreyer?
And the counterpart to brachial power is rhetoric, correct? Because it wasn't Socrates' justice simply that allowed him to win.
No, no, Socrates proved to be better. I mean, Socrates gained universal, or almost universal agreement.
But wouldn't we say that was more due to his superior speaking ability than to his justice?
Yeah, but, yeah, sure, I myself said that, but we must not forget Socrates' injustice is of a particular kind. It is an injustice in the service of justice. If you want to have a humble contemporary example, I'm sure there is no one here, I believe not even you, and you, who do not know the character of Perry Mason. Do you? Thursday from 7 to 8. And you must see that if you want to understand this country. And Perry Mason, who also commits acts of breaking and entering, you know, and quite a few other things, and yet never in order to feather his own nest, but always for the sake of justice. Now, on a grander scale, that is done by Socrates. No, don't laugh about that. And Perry Mason is described by his creator as, how does he call it? Clean like a hound's tooth and sharp like a steel trap. This man has understood an important point of Aristotle's ethics, the difference between moral and intellectual virtue. So don't despise these
people. I don't despise. I laugh over another.
And?
Laugh over another.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Why is the group neither is a good nor the opposite?
I see now that Rackham is a translator of that, who also makes a translation of the politics of us for the verbs. He's really much better than that. His translation, to repeat, appropriate act is much better, but that is the best. Now go on.
It is clear also that some actions performed by the wise men of the spirit, these neutral things.
Wait a moment. You see this very astonishing assertion to begin with, that what we are in the habit of calling duties belongs neither to the good nor to the bad things. What can that possibly mean? Let us face that riddle. We will get an answer on the next page. Yeah, begin again with paragraph 59.
It is also clear that some actions are performed by the wise man in the sphere of these neutral things. Well then, when he does such an action, he judges it to be an appropriate act. And as his judgment on this point never errs, therefore appropriate action will exist in the sphere of these neutral things. The same thing is also proved by the following argument. We observe that something exists which we call right action, but this is an appropriate act perfectly performed.
You know, this perfectum officium in Latin, what he spoke before, you have the perfect duty, as the other translator says. Yeah?
Therefore, there will also be such a thing as an imperfect appropriate act.
You see, that is clear. If there can be a perfect appropriate act, there must also be imperfect one. Otherwise it wouldn't make sense to speak of perfect, yeah? And now he gives an example which is a bit blurred in the translation, yeah?
So that, if to restore a trust is a matter of principle, is a right act, to restore a trust must be counted as appropriate.
Yeah, that is simply an error of the printer, I am trust. Literally translated. So that, if to restore something justly deposited, is a right act, yeah? To restore something deposited must be counted as a duty. That is, I think, we must stop here. Do you see the difference? I mean, we ordinarily say,